I'm Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. This is the beginning of our second season, and we are at episode one. This is where we love giving well. At the front end of this podcast, I just want to begin by thanking you for joining in to listen today. In our first season, we produced 18 episodes of this podcast, and today marks the launch of season two. I have plans this season for some fascinating interviews that will help make your philanthropy stronger. Whether you give a little or a lot, hearing how others do it well is one way to grow. I'm really pleased to begin with an exceptional interview with a fascinating man, Steve Moore. Steve is the CEO of one of the largest foundations I know, Murdoch Trust, which is based in the Pacific Northwest in Vancouver, Washington, just across the Columbia River from Portland. Imagine $1.1 billion under management and annual disbursements last year of almost $50 million. Without further ado, let's jump into the interview now. Steve Moore, welcome today to the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Now, I met you 10 or 12 years ago. I can't quite remember how many years it was, but I recall being on a small plane with you, flying from Portland to Vancouver, BC.
That's exactly right. And probably one of the first times was when we had a group of funders together in Vancouver, BC, talking about the importance of philanthropy and particularly family philanthropy.
Yeah. And now I'm intrigued because when I met you back in those days, you were just coming into your role at Murdoch. And I think you had either just started or you were about to just start the position you currently have. Can you tell us your journey up to that point and where you landed?
I had, prior to coming to the Murdoch Trust, had been involved in higher education for about 25 years. Most of my career was higher education, teaching at the college level and college at leadership and administration in three or four different institutions, public and private institutions. I had also, along the way, applied for and received and been turned down for some grants.
So you know what it's like.
totally know that feeling. Been there, and I've been across from good grant makers, and I've been across the table from bad grant makers. And so I never, ever imagined myself working in philanthropy. I thought I would spend my whole career in higher education. And I did come from a family of educators. And so I was, in a sense, brought up asking questions and being encouraged to ask questions, to be a lifelong learner, to kind of be adventuresome. And to exercise leadership, encouraged to exercise leadership. And so all of those things kind of played into my story. And I was fortunate. I was the vice president of Seattle Pacific University, and we had applied for some grants at the Murdoch Trust. I came down, had some conversations. We eventually got the grants, and actually got turned down for one or two from Murdoch. They began to ask me to give feedback and be on review panels and provide input. A couple of times I gave them some very stark, honest, direct feedback that made everyone at the university I was working at very nervous because I was so direct. It turned out that while a couple of the people at the Murdoch Trust were a little taken back by that honesty, the leadership of the trust greatly appreciated. And we've looked back on that now, and they thought that was pretty fantastic. It actually led to some just some other kinds of conversations. Then a couple of times asked if I'd be interested in coming for this position or that position. I said no, because as I said, I never imagined myself working in philanthropy. I actually went on the board of a couple of family foundations and then also worked in an advisory role and was eventually at a couple of the schools I was at. I was actually on the that those schools would have a foundation side of the house, and I would be on either in charge of that or working in that. So it gave me just a lot of exposure from a different perspective of philanthropy. And then, you know, I think I just really came to appreciate, because of friends and because of these family foundations, just the great challenge of investing in organization and leaders in wise and effective ways. It's hard work.
Yeah.
And so I just don't take it for granted.
And that led you to Murdoch, and the position became vacant, I guess, to lead the organization.
Yeah. Yes. So they had the Neil Thorpe, who had been the CEO, called me, said, "I'm going to retire. We'd like for you to think about coming to the trust."
Huh.
Said, "Neil, I don't think I'm the right person, but let me give some thought to it and I'll get you some names." And he circled back and said, "You'll be hearing from our search firm. We think you should throw your name in the hat." And I said, "That's great." They called back and asked if I would at least fly out and visit with them and kind of talk about the role. So I actually did that. Didn't hear from
And you thought you were talking about someone else's role.
Yeah. They eventually called me back and said, "We'd like for you to come." And I said, "Wow. You know, I just don't see us moving right now. It's kind of not a good window of time to be making a move." And long and the short of it is, they called back and said, "You know, we think that this is a good match for you. We'd like for you to take some time to think about it, pray about it." And I guess, as they say, the rest is history.
Wow.
So they were being very discerning and very encouraging. And some of the things that I saw as possibilities, they were willing to, in a sense, let me kind of dream as to what it might look like.
That's neat. So maybe describe Murdoch Trust for us, because I know when I went out 10 or 12 years ago and met you for the first time, I met a wonderful expression of philanthropy, family philanthropy, really, that surpassed any expectation I had. And it has such an interesting story and unique identifiers. Can you describe for us?
It is a private charitable trust. There are no family members involved, because Jack Murdoch, who left his entire estate to create the trust, was a single man with no siblings and no surviving family.
Wow.
And never been married, no children. So he basically gave us the charge to nurture and enrich the educational, cultural, social, and spiritual life of individuals, families, and communities. And it was the first generation of trustees who, as they began to enter into the work of the foundation, realized that they couldn't operate on a national or international scale because of the amount of resources they had. So they kind of focused it in at the time on the Pacific Northwest, which is where Jack Murdoch had done a lot of his own business. He had been a co-founder of Tektronix, an investor in a number of different kinds of businesses. And so after all of the his possessions were liquidated, it was about $91 million, and the trust launched in 1975. So now it's 40 years later. And
you've grown a bit since then.
And so we now have grown to about over a billion, about 1.1 billion, and we've given away about 875 million in grants and additional resources in terms of leadership development and program development.
Wow.
So it's a great story, and it's a very much of a Jack Murdoch value in the early trustees, that to take the long view, to invest deeply, pick particular sectors to invest in, and that kind of thing.
Describe for a bit the sense of place that I get when I look at Murdoch Trust, the five-state region you're focused on. And for me, it's quite unique, and it feels so organic and so, I don't know, embedded in your own local culture. And I love that for Murdoch.
We work in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Alaska, and British Columbia, the Pacific Northwest. And we focus on arts and culture, science, research, and education, health and human services, and then education, primarily private, but also other education as well. And so those kinds of things, it's kind of a general purpose trust in a sense, but we try to identify either underserved areas or areas that that will really help the long-term flourishing of individuals, families, and communities.
And how many are on your staff at this point?
We have kind of an unusual staff. We probably have about 25 full-time people, but we utilize a lot of adjunct people. We have a number of senior fellows. We always have a visiting scholar. We have interns. We have panels. We utilize a lot of volunteers and people to help us on panels with specialty areas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not a big staff, but we try to really have what we call an ecosystem of leadership that really makes sure that we're bringing kind of the best thinking to grant making and programs that we do.
Can you maybe describe for us some of the challenges you face running a large foundation like Murdoch? I'm sure the challenges are many and quite significant when you consider the amount of funding that's going out and requests being sought from you.
Yeah. I think one thing that has been important for us is to develop a process and be very true to our process, to be very transparent in terms of the kind of questions that we're going to ask organizations. So up on our website, we're very clear with groups to say, here are questions you're going to either get asked in your application or in your site visit, or in a conversation with a program director, or some other part of the process. So we try to be very transparent as to what we're looking for in order to make a good investment. That takes out the kind of, you know, leveraging or those kinds of things that some people would like to think maybe helps. And it brings a kind of an objectivity to it that kind of is what I would say brings the best thinking to bear, so that we're really making recommendations that are kind of the highest and best thinking that we're able to get to. Mm-hmm. So we're very transparent in that regard. We're transparent. We say to organizations, feel free to go on our website, identify people that we've made grants to, and make them part of your learning community. So they can call up someone who's received a grant and say, help us understand X, or help us understand Y, or we're having trouble filling out this form. Mm-hmm. How do we kind of get there? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we try to be very transparent in that regard, and we try to make sure that there's kind of an objectivity to the process, so that people know that there's no secret black box kind of a thing that goes into the decision making.
There's not a secret pill to swallow, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Or they have to kind of
say the right words.
Exactly. And oftentimes people hope that if they can just convince us of their mission,
yeah,
that and inspire us, that we will jump on board. And, you know, what we often say to them is, we already believe in your mission. We love your mission. Now we've got to get down to the business of helping helping you build a great organization so you can fulfill that mission. And so we're going to ask you some very hard questions to make sure that you're on that learning trajectory.
Would you be more inclined to fund organizations that have a healthier organization, or one, or would your funding go to ones that you want them to become healthier through your funding?
Yeah, it would be a combination of both. What we are looking for is a trajectory of growth and healthiness that is headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
And so whether it be the board or finances or leadership or service to the constituency they're seeking to serve, we want to see a positive trajectory of growth. And we want them to understand and be able to articulate what that is, no matter which area it may be in.
Right. I know on your website, and I've heard through colleagues that have told me about it, about your enrichment programming that you offer at Murdoch. Can you just describe that for our listeners today and how that fits into all of this?
Yeah. One of the things that we find is that sometimes there are other ways that we can better serve an organization. And so we've identified some ways in which, through programs that we do, we feel like we build the capacity of an organization. It falls into three distinct categories that we call enrichment. One is in science education. And one is in the area of what we call capacity building. And the third is in a very particular area of Christian leadership development. We're a private trust, but we don't discriminate against faith-based groups. We find a lot of organizations, a lot of foundations will discriminate these days against faith-based groups.
Right.
And we find that particularly Christian faith-based groups have been discriminated against. And so we provide some special enrichment opportunities for young emerging leaders, for women who are at mid-level and rising leaders, and then for executive presidents and senior leaders. So that's kind of the Christian leadership area. The capacity building area, we work with small organizations and help them put together what we call the essentials of development. What does a healthy development program look like? Very robust program, and we work with groups, just a very wide variety. We also do some things on succession planning and some things on board development. Those are the areas of the capacity building. And then in science, we have a program that works with high school science teachers and one that works with college researchers and college teachers and doing their research, primarily in undergraduate research laboratories.
That's really exciting. I like the breadth of what you're offering there. And I like, especially given my own orientation is a Christian, and that you're not discriminating against those faith-based organizations, that you're creating a special place for them within your leadership materials and development.
We find that faith-based groups oftentimes confuse mission with organizational effectiveness. And they have all come to their mission because they believe in it. And the thing that many of them have not come to is the place where they realize that if they have a more effective organization, it will actually help them reach their mission in a more robust way. And so they would like to spend all their time just on the inspiration side and not on the organizational effectiveness side. But those two are very closely related.
Right. Can you give us a few examples of grants that you feel have done well through organizations where you've done well through your granting?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one we get asked a lot, and it's always hard to kind of single out.
Yeah, I know.
I would say, you know, many times when we talk about helping an organization build its capacity, we kind of put it into three or four buckets. One is, did we help them in the what we might call build the capacity of their facility? And to really think through what is the most effective facility or addition. Many times groups say, we just need to add more space. Well, they haven't thought through the effective use of space. So many of the grants that have helped with people building out new space have been super effective and fruitful grants. It's helped them build their capacity space-wise. Another is we make a lot of grants related to technology. Technology is an intimidating and overwhelming area. We just built a new website so we can relate to it firsthand. But technology is a servant, not a master.
Right.
And so it's really helping groups understand how does it help you build your capacity to serve. So technology, we've made a lot of great grants there. We've made a lot of great grants in terms of new personnel positions. Oftentimes our grants help them add persons in very strategic areas and to do it in such a way that it doesn't hit all of their budget at the same time. They kind of are able to spread it out over 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then the other is what we call program expansion. They may say, we have a new program we want to introduce. We think this is going to really have a huge impact on our ability to deliver. And you could go on our website and we list all the grants that we've made. And I think you could see what many of those are. And, you know, we feel like that, you know, many of those are, in fact, I would say a majority of those we feel like have really been great grants.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to direct our conversation now towards the role that we have as philanthropists. Can be more than grant making. It's more than just a transaction. But indeed, we are actually influencing society in some way. Have you thought through that? And have you considered how Murdoch is influencing your society in the Northwest?
Yeah. The way we hope to kind of be engaged in the culture, I think there's probably three main areas that we would say. I think that number one, we can convene people to come together and be in conversation that may not come together otherwise. I think that's one of the roles that philanthropy can play as a convener that's a very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other is, or a second is, that oftentimes people are not aware of other groups that are seeking to accomplish the same mission in ways that they could learn from. So often we play that key role of connecting people, learning about best practices, challenging them on the kinds of ways that they can partner with others as well as collaborate and learn from others. So that's kind of the second is playing the role of connector. And then the third thing is I think that we, play this role with our enrichment programs and with the kinds of ways we can challenge board members, executive leaders, and others to continue to grow as an organization and to make them aware of the kinds of resources and opportunities that will help them to continue to grow. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to continue to grow. And so what I often say to people is if you're waiting for competition to help you become better,
mm-hmm.
You'll always be externally motivated. The only thing that's more powerful than competition is a calling. If you respond to your calling, that is way more powerful than if you simply wait for competition to come along and improve what you're doing.
That's beautiful. An internal motivation to push you forward. That brings me to my last question, which is, where are you going in the future? as you're being called forward and as this drive is coming from within?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things I would say in reply. One is that we push ourselves pretty hard to really ask ourselves that continuous quality improvement question. How might we improve our processes, our programs, our grant making? How might we do that better? And to keep the constituencies that are ultimately being served as the end users that we care about. So we're always asking that continuous quality improvement question. Second thing is we are always saying, what new is going on in our culture that we need to address in some way or another, or that we might be able to contribute to in some way or another? We feel like that civility, the public discourse, volunteerism, civic engagement, that those things are being strained to the very limits.
Yes.
So we're asking ourselves, who are the people and where are the groups that are doing the best job at helping bring people together, helping people who may disagree to learn to work together on things that they can agree on? So those are the kinds of things that we're asking ourselves right now and are trying to work on and address. And then I think the third thing is that we're always asking ourselves the question, you know, any region of the country, any particular state or city can become very provincial in its thinking and think, you know, there's nobody else in the country like Seattle. There's nobody else in the country like Portland. There's nobody else in the country like Bozeman or Boise or Fairbanks or whatever. And the reality is, we are more alike than we're different, and we need to learn from one another, and we need to connect with one another. And so we're always just asking that connect the dots kind of question. How can we get people to connect with one another, to learn from one another, to grow and to work together? And to, I mean, it's sort of like what you're doing, Mark, with the work you're doing.
Yeah.
It's that you're taking advantage of a technology to help people be continuous learners. And so those kinds of things we just think are so valuable.
Thanks, Steve, for taking time to join us and to share your thoughts today. This kind of conversation really makes me think about how to improve on our philanthropy. You know, philanthropy isn't just about giving money away. It also acknowledges a role in society, as Steve mentioned, to convene, connect, and shape culture. There's a leadership aspect to philanthropy that doesn't involve the awarding of funds, but instead influences for change. You can find out more about Murdoch Trust in the show notes. Take time to explore their website and learn some of the ways they do their philanthropy. I'm excited today to give you a heads up on some news. I have a book coming out soon. The book is called Love Giving Well, Philanthropy as Pilgrimage, and it explores my philanthropy journey and what I learned over the years about good giving. My publisher contacted me recently and sent the final typeset copy, which I'm just touching up before I return it to him. Stay tuned to the release date for the book by subscribing to our e-newsletter. And of course, I'll let you know here as well. That concludes today's podcast. You can subscribe to this one at our website at strongerphilanthropy.ca, or you can find us on iTunes or your Android podcatcher apps. If you want to reach out, please feel free to connect by email at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. Message me on Twitter at @lovegivingwell or on Facebook at Stronger Philanthropy. Buen camino.